Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of Paddock Chat, a West Midlands Group original podcast created to keep local growers in the loop without having to leave the paddock. My name is Simon Kruger, and I'm the Graduate Communications Officer at the West Midlands Group. In this bumper episode, Dr. Mike Ashworth, Research Agronomist at the Australian Herbicide Resistance Initiative, and Matt Willis, Market Development Agronomist at Bayer Crop Science, share their knowledge and experiences with weed control in farming systems. WMG Executive Officer Nathan Craig leads these two special guests on a deep dive into the key elements of an effective herbicide strategy based on research and trials they have been working on over the last few years. Not only is this episode coming out right when our farmers need the information the most to be able to tweak their plans for the year, but it also contains a huge amount of topical, focused and useful information in a genuinely open and easy to follow conversation. So without further ado, let's get on with the episode. The information provided in this podcast is general in nature and may not be wholly appropriate for your purposes or situation. We recommend that you seek appropriate professional advice before implementing actions based on the information provided in this podcast.
Today on the West Midlands Group Paddock Chat podcast, we have two guests on board to talk about all things weed control related. Matt Willis from Bayer Crop Science and Michael Ashworth from the Australian Herbicide Resistance Initiative. And today we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into the key elements of an effective herbicide strategy based on the research that they've been doing over the last couple of years. So just a quick disclaimer, this podcast was recorded in March 2022 in preparation for the season ahead. And while the herbicide use patterns can change, many of the broader strategies that we're going to discuss today should stand the test of time. So first of all, I'll just ask if you could each please introduce yourselves. And as a bit of a twist, what's your role that you see yourself playing in agricultural industry? So if you want to go first, Matt.
Yeah, g'day, Nath. Pleasure to be here. And yeah, always interesting times in these podcasts and such and digital technologies as opposed to the usual face-to-face presentations. But yeah, really good to be here. Yeah, myself, I'm the market development agronomist for the Northern WA Wheatbelt for Bayer. What that generally means, what my role is in the industry, is to sort of, it's a hybrid role between, say, marketing, sales and development, in that I'll generally get access to Bayer products about 4 or 5 years before they're commercially released, and I'll get hold of them, sort of find where they fit in with WA farming practices and try and figure out any issues before they get released, say. So then I start working with, firstly, advisors and consultants, agronomists, research bodies, such as with ARI, just get them used to the product, like let them understand the product, and then a year or so in before it's released, start showing this product off to farmers. And then for the first few years after release, it's about technical queries, getting the best out of this product. So it's sort of a new products kind of market, making sure that everything that we need to know about them, we know through trial work and bioassays and technical presentations. And then, making sure once it's out in the field that any technical queries, any physical issues with it are sorted out so that it's a good solid release and everyone knows everything they need.
It sounds like a really exciting space to be in.
It's in a, particularly a company like Bayer, the very innovative products. These within 2 or 3 years have been played around with in Victoria. We get access to them over here, and it's always that moment of apprehension when you first use a product to see how well does it perform in Australian conditions and Australian weeds, and how safe it is on Australian crops and in our soil types. And there's been a few hopes dashed along the way where something's looked really good, and for whatever reason, it's either touched up the crop, or there's been residue issues, or environmental issues, and things have been knocked on the head right before release. And that can be a bit devastating, but it can be quite rewarding when you get something really innovative. And probably the classic one on Bayer's behalf of the last 15 or so years has been Sakura. And I remember speaking to the person over in Adelaide who first saw pyroxasulfone as a coated line in a small plot trial. It would have been about 15 years ago, and they looked, that looks pretty good, and we looked at it closer, and it ended up being what we know as Sakura now, and has been such a useful tool in agriculture and has changed a lot of the ways we farm, particularly with dry seeding and herbicide control. It's quite exciting in that regard.
Sounds really good. So, Mike, what's your role and at ARI, and then also, what role do you play in the ag industry?
So, within ARI, I don't know what I do across the wider ag industry other than just talk to a lot of people. But within ARI, basically, what we do is we're basically trying to work out how we control multiple herbicide-resistant populations and populations that are becoming really, really problematic to control. So, for instance, we've got widespread herbicide resistance. We've got resistance to you know, 6 to 7 modes of action in annual ryegrass. They're really, really becoming very, very difficult to control. And then we're also getting populations that are changing their life cycle. So they're learning to evade weed control tools. So, you know, we need to learn how to change up, how to add more diversity into our weed control systems in order to control these guys. So it's a fairly challenging job. And what we do is we're not just sitting in the glasshouse or the lab. We take stuff to the field to do massive trials basically out there. And then talking and working with growers and agronomists on how can we then go on and improve and diversify our weed control systems to control these herbicide resistant weeds. It seems like a real arms race. You know, every time we develop a new tool, the resistant weeds are developing a new countermeasure. You know, so, and it's just, I'm never going to be out of a job, mate. We're constantly going to be working on it.
Yeah, that seems so. And so it sounds like it's a really kind of independent sort of role within the ag industry and in that kind of weed control space.
Yeah, so we work very, very closely with the GRDC, the Grains Research Development Corporation, and I've got a team of 4 guys that work for me here, and we're just basically just out there all the time, all across the state. We do trials from last year, we did trials at Mininew right down through to Esperance. So we get to see a lot of the state, talk to a lot of guys, and it's a great job. Love it.
That sounds good. So first of all, I'd like to touch on some of the trials that Matt had in our region and across the Northern Ag region in the last year. We've worked, you know, over a lot of years with Bayer and Matt in particular, you know, looking at different weed and disease control strategies and then products suited to our region. Can you summarise, Matt, just some of the results that, you know, what you found last year in the trials, you know, within the West Midlands region? We had a trial at our Springfield Day site, and then how that fit in with across the rest of the Northern Ag region in particular.
Yep, thanks, Matt. So, yeah, as I mentioned before, in my role, looking at products that are either just released or about to be released, my focus last year, as it had been for probably 2 or 3 years prior to that, had been on developing and promoting, I suppose you could be the correct word, a herbicide called Matino Complete from Bayer, using it in different scenarios, different soil types, different environmental conditions, and yeah, different areas, and then showing advisors and growers how it would be beneficial to them in their systems. So the trial at West Midlands Group last year, 2021, at Springfield Day site, was with Matino Complete. It had 2 trials actually adjacent. One was focused on annual ryegrass control, so with Matino Complete with its use patterns up against industry standards, and then same again with a wild radish trial. So the wild radish trial had different systems which people usually use for wild radish control, so your various IBS products followed by a Jaguar type product or a Velocity type product, and then a few of the IBS options like Callistos and Viraxors, and then comparing that with how Matino Complete performs in its use patterns. So yeah, that's sort of a culmination of all the trial I've done over the previous few years leading up to what is now a registered product going into the 2022 season. So what we saw in this trial, and this was a part of a series of trials throughout the Northern WA wheat belt, which was all collated together for a data set at the end, which is all in the West Midlands Group quarterly, which is just came out, I believe. And the best performing product, as we've seen consistently for the last few years, has been that Matino Complete with a post-emergent application. So an early post-emergent application, sort of I'm seeing the best level of control when applying it sort of between 1 leaf and 3 leaf crop in wheat. And that's after an effective pre-emergent product like a trifluralin or a trialate or a prosulfocarb in front of it. And it's bringing the level of ryegrass, annual ryegrass control up from, yeah, best case scenario with IBS options being around that sort of 90% on average, up to, yeah, well in excess of 95%. And this is due to, we see this to a degree with products like prosulfocarb and Voxigold, which can also be used in this sort of use pattern, is controlling those weeds in the furrow. And that's the big weakness of all these IBS options we have out there. Obviously, IBS options, they're fantastic for logistical reasons because we're going out there generally with a knockdown before or in front of the bar, and we're going over the boom spray anyway. It's great in that regard, but it does mean that particularly with knife point press wheel systems where we're throwing both the soil and the chemical out of the furrow into the interrow, is that yes, we get good control with a lot of those products in the interrow, but in the furrow itself, we do get weeds germinating up with the crop. And so obviously in the past, ancient days gone by, we'd have options like hoegrass and some of the various SUs are particularly good at controlling ryegrass, but yeah, resistance has done away with that. And it's only really now the Voxigold and prosulfocarb are the 2 that go into that slot. And It's obviously got some limitations with the requirement for moisture, getting in really early to get into the weeds prior to a certain stage, generally about 2.5 leaf is when you sort of want it in there by. And then, yeah, crop safety, given that, for certain reasons, can cause some crop effects. So Matina Complete, probably should summarise what it is exactly, and it's a combination of three active ingredients, peroxisulfone, which you'd be familiar with Sakura, diflufenican, which is Brodel, and a new active ingredient, which is a brand new mode of action for Australia called aclonafen, and it controls both broadleaf weeds and grass weeds in wheat and barley, and registered for use pre-emergent, with the traditional pre-emergent usage. But yeah, this one I've just been talking about, it's a post-emergent strategy. So it's registered from one leaf crop in wheat up until early tillering. And yeah, that post-emergent is where it's better than, I'd say marginally better than Sakura IBS, but it's really an EPE, early post-emergent strategy, where we are seeing that big jump up in control, where we for various reasons, the in-furrow aspect, which I just spoke about, but also one thing you've got to consider with all these products is the residual control, how much residual you get out of these products. And we generally work on, in bale, peroxisulfone, Sakura, you get about 12 to 14 weeks residual. So that's from when you apply it. So say if you're going in dry in sort of early May, that gets you through May, gets you through June, gets you to the end of back end of July, and then it runs out of puff around August. Then you might get a few later cohorts coming through. Generally, they're not overly vigorous and don't have too many panicles, but they are there. But with Matina, you've got to think, if we're putting this out in the crop around that sort of 1 to 3 leaf crop stage, it's on average going to be in that sort of early June timing, first week or two of June timing. And that means that 12 to 14 weeks residual then pushes through later, the back end of the season, to the back end of August and into September. So it means that tail end of that residual is shifted an extra month into the back end of the season. So we're getting that really high level of control, stopping those later germinators getting through. But then, as I mentioned before also, is we're getting broadleaf control from this application too. So not only is it replacing an IBS product in the system, but it's also replacing a Jaguar or Velocity type early post-emergent broadleaf spray too. So we're not really a traditional high weed burden ryegrass and wild rider scenario. You're going with a Sakura Treflan pre, coming back with something similar, and then coming back with a Jaguar or Velocity type product around that 3-leaf crop stage to take out the broadleaf weeds. This is not really adding any additional passes. It's moving that Sakura or equivalent Luxamax, whatever, spend from IBS into that early post-emergent spread we are traditionally going across with that Jaguar or Velocity type spray. And instead, that's where the Matina goes. So having a trifluralin pre, with or without a knockdown, going through with your bar, then coming through once the crop's at that sort of 1 to 3 leaf crop stage, coming back with a Matina to take out those grass weeds and those broadleaf weeds. And from the trial, so I said the West Midlands trial last year, that strategy of, in this case, 2 liters of trifluralin pre and coming back with 1 liter of Matina Complete post-emergent, early post-emergent, was getting 99% reduction of annual ryegrass panicles. So from an 809 panicles per square meter in the untreated down to 6 panicles per square meter in that treatment. And then also getting 99% control also with the wild radish. So really, really high levels of control. And on average, across all those trials I did in the region last year, it worked out about 95% annual ryegrass panicle reduction for that treatment, and about 97% for the wild radish control as well. So very, very high levels of control, which is quite impressive and comparing it to the other systems. And one thing I like to convey to people with this product is it's not going to replace the IBS component of the system. It's just purely down to logistics. We need to think about what we're able to do with our gear, with our boom spray around that critical timing in June. We're obviously doing a lot of things around then. We're doing post-emergent sprays in canola, in lupins. We're doing broadleaf sprays in some of the earlier sown cereal crops as well. So it's about what can we achieve in that critical timing, because we don't really want to be going out with the strategy once the weeds have started tillering. So there's only a few weeks window we can do this, and there's only so much ground we can cover. So it's only ever going to be a portion of the program as a tool to control weed numbers in certain paddocks. There's always going to be a scenario where you're using a wide array of your IBS options in other paddocks, because you just can't cover the ground at that timing to get what you need, get the control you need. One other thing that we really discovered or really showcased last year with Matina, with that early post-emergent timing, is we need to treat it still like a residual product. It's not like a Hograss or a Velocity where we're waiting for a germination of weeds to control. This is still a residual product, both for the broadleaf weeds and for the grasses, and still knockdown component to it. But we don't need to wait for a germination of weeds. I'm finding the best level of control consistently is to get on there earlier, so from 1 leaf onwards, even if the weeds aren't there, and then treating it like a residual, because you still get the residuals. You're still getting, we'll be claiming 14 weeks residual for grasses, 7 weeks residual for broadleaf weeds, which is more than what we're seeing out of a Jaguar spray in some conditions. And yeah, getting it really early, and that's getting this high level of weed control. So that's what we're going to be based on what we've found out from these trials here, is getting on early is going to be the highest likelihood of any high level of control.
Mike, West Midlands Group were fortunate to have one of your trial sites in our region for the last 2 years, actually. Mm. Can you just kind of talk a little bit about what you were looking at in your trials and kind of what the key findings you found either in our region or more broadly across WA? I think you had a whole network of trials as well.
Yeah, we had a truckload of trials. We actually did 9 trials over 3 years from 2019 through to 2021. And we were sort of coming in with quite a large research question. And the concept we came in with was dry sowing with a highly competitive crop and a highly residual pre-emergent herbicide package going to be better than delayed sowing, you know, for weed control, you know, where we get that knockdown for weed control? We know that when we sow early, we get a yield kick. We know that our crops are more vigorous when we sow early and so generally so dry, because we're sowing into warm conditions. Those crops really get up and going. So was that additional crop competition plus a more residual pre-emergent herbicide package going to give us a better outcome than delayed sowing into cooler conditions but still getting that knockdown? And, yeah, so we did trials in 2019 from, you know, right up at Minnanew, Myling, York. We did 2020, we did Pingerley, Kojonup, Dandaragan. And in 21, we did York, Dandaragan, and then all the way down in Esperance. So we got a wide range of the state and a lot of different environments. And we actually put a soil logger in every trial. So we measured the soil moisture at every site and also the soil temperature. So we could sort of compare and contrast the responses at different sites to see what we got there. Within the trial, we had 2 times of sowing. So basically we sowed dry in that first week of May. And then we had a delayed sowing treatment about 5 weeks after. So we're talking about the second week in June. So in order to pick up the disparity between a delayed sowing system and a full-on dry and sown system. And we had 3 wheat seeding densities within there. So we wanted to pick up competition within that. So we had 100, 150 and 200 plants per square metre. So, you know, 150 plants is about that 70 kilos a hectare. 100 plants is around 45 and 200 plants is up around that 90 kilos a hectare. And then we had 7 different pre-emergent herbicide treatments within there. We obviously had a nil, so no herbicide at all. We had 2 litres of trifluralin, which is our standard, 2.5 litres of Boxer, 500 mils of Luximax, 118 grams of Sakura, a full lick of Matino Complete being 1 litre, and 1.25 litres of Overwatch. We checked out how those treatments worked with those different levels of competition and dry sowing.
Yeah, cool. And so do you have a clear winner that come out of that, or what are your thoughts there?
Oh, so we did a lot of measurements throughout the year. So we did the standard stuff where we measured the amount of ryegrass seed production, we measured the yields, and I'll talk about those later. But probably the most interesting thing about it is we went to each site every 2 weeks after sowing, and we did a bioassay. So what we did was we took a soil sample of the top 7 centimetres of soil in the interrow, because that's where you throw the herbicide out after sowing. We throw that into the interrow, and then we took those samples for every herbicide back to the university. We plated them up into basically Chinese food containers, and then we sowed in susceptible annual ryegrass. So we know that ryegrass that we're going to be able to control. And then what we did was we used a measure of the shoot length to work out how effective that herbicide still was. So you've seen Khalil a couple of years ago did a really nice study showing that he correlated the chemistry, the chemical analysis of the herbicide in that soil to the shoot length. And he found a very, very strong correlation. So it was a really good way of measuring it on the cheap. So what we're looking for is if you get a long shoot length, that means your herbicide's not very effective. There's not a lot of herbicide efficacy there. But if it's got a very, very short length, it's been really knocked back, then you know that your herbicide's still working particularly well. And what we did was we measured each site for approximately 20 weeks after sowing, so a long time. And, you know, backing up what Matt said, yeah, we did see products like Matino Complete, like Overwatch, really, they do have that residual capacity well past 14 weeks there. Even Sakura is a pretty good product. But what we actually also found was a real dichotomy between the products there. So we found products like Trifluralin, Boxer Gold and Luximax have a relatively short residual period to them, Okay, so they're not necessarily well suited to a dry sowing condition on their own. However, products like Sakura, Mateno Complete, and especially Overwatch, which was our most residual product we found in the study, they stuck around well past that 14 weeks, providing that level of control. So, you know, they've got a real fit within a dry sowing system.
West Midlands Group members will be able to read more about these trials in the next edition of the WMG Quarterly. There is, I know from, you know, sitting down with Mike and looking through this, there is a lot of detail and a lot of really good data that's come out of all of these sites.
Yeah. So what we did was we went through the site and we, in the end of the day, we got towards the end of the site around anthesis, so around sort of the head starting to mature for the wheat. We went to each trial and we actually took massive cuts of crop and also for the biomass of the crop, but also for the ryegrass. So then what we did was we threshed that ryegrass. We actually measured the amount of ryegrass, the seed that was produced. We also did a viability test on top of that to make sure that that seed was viable. And what we actually found was that the ryegrass seed production, or the viable ryegrass seed production that was produced in those, within each one of those treatments, was affected very, very heavily by the herbicide used, which was going to be pretty obvious, right? So obviously our nil treatment where we had no herbicide had dramatically the greatest, but we also had relatively robust amounts of ryegrass produced in the trifluralin and the Boxer Gold and the Luximax treatments. However, they were correlated very closely to the herbicides that had the less residual capacity. So you've got to think, if a herbicide is not very residual, it's able to get its growth on and it's able to compete against the wheat in that situation and produce quite a bit of seed. But if a herbicide is highly residual and still very, very active, things like Sakura, Mateno Complete and Overwatch, what they do is that they really suppress the growth of the ryegrass, allowing the wheat to get a competitive advantage over that ryegrass and really limiting the amount of ryegrass seed production within that system. So, you know, that's what we found there, was that the amount of ryegrass seed that was produced directly correlated to the residual capacity of the pre-emergent herbicide. So we really need to understand the characteristics of that herbicide. So is it residual? Is it not? Use it in the right situation. So if we're going for a delayed sowing and we get a good knockdown where we're taking a lot of ryegrass out of the seed bank and we're only dealing with a more dormant component, then we actually found the products like Trifluralin, Boxer Gold and Luximax had a really good fit. Okay, but they didn't necessarily have that standalone fit in that dry sowing situation. The other thing we really found is that sort of complementary nature between crop competition and the herbicide. Okay, so if the herbicide's a little bit weaker, especially in a dry sowing situation, you really need to crank your seeding rate up. Okay, you know, that provides that level of redundancy. It sort of goes hand in hand with the herbicide. You've got to remember the herbicide is really clipping the wings of that ryegrass. It's really pulling it back. You will need enough plants, wheat plants there to actually suppress and stop the ryegrass seed production from occurring. So it's what the pre-emergent herbicide is doing is it's giving the wheat a competitive advantage in order to take away all of the light, space and moisture resources away from the ryegrass in order to stop the ryegrass from setting seed. So I hope that makes a bit of sense there.
There are a lot of interactions. I guess that's the thing about the farming system, is that there's so many interactions of how everything, you know, comes together to give effective weed control. And I mean, that's where I'd kind of like to go now. You know, this, we're recording this podcast. It's going to be released about 3 weeks away from seeding across much of WA. We think that's about the middle of April. Most people are going by then. So let's have a look at kind of potentially what could happen, you know, for this year and some of the considerations. So considering where we're at now, do any of you want to make a prediction what the break of the season is going to look like?
We might actually look quite foolish, Nath, if the season's already happened by the time this podcast comes out. You never know when a cyclone might come rolling down.
my dicky knee's starting to play up there, Nathan, so I think it's going to be a ripper.
How the black cockies going out at down Darragon Way right now?
Yeah,
I've heard the gum trees are flowering as well.
Yeah, they are as well, and the ants were going pretty mad too. So all of that says that there's a season coming ahead.
Okay. Absolutely.
One of the things I like to do is throw around a few different scenarios. One of my favourite pastimes is scenario planning, and it's two things that really can impact on the overall effectiveness, as we've kind of touched on already, is, you know, whether we get an early break versus a late break, And then whether that's actually a really good wet start with a good heap of rain, or whether it's a dry sort of rain where you can get the crop out of the ground, but there's only kind of 5, 10, 15 mil events that you just kind of sneak through. How would growers, what sort of things would growers need to be considering in their weed management strategy as we go through each of these scenarios? So if we start with early kind of dry break, what's likely to be a good herbicide strategy there? And then, what's the likely impact on weed control going to
be? So you're saying early dry as in little intermittent rainfall events that aren't overly soaking things up, they're just getting a germination and then...
Yeah.
And that's one we, when Sakura first came out, that sort of 2013 was the year, it coincided exactly with that scenario in that we'd been playing around with Sakura and you either go in dry and it's great because it just sits there and it doesn't do anything until it does rain and then the weeds germinate at the same time the chemicals activated. And then there was the wet scenarios where you'd apply your Sakura into wet soil and everything's happy days. But then that 2013 scenario is a bit like what you're describing there. And it was a little bit of a wet, dry, almost a false break. And people were applying Sakura into sort of half wet, half dry paddocks, go through with the bar, the crop came up, and then there was no real follow-up rainfall for a while afterwards. And so the Sakura hadn't been activated because there wasn't enough soil solution from that rain prior to application, and then there was no follow-up rain to then get it into solution once again. And it meant that the Sakura was inert, and then the weeds were germinating, and it wasn't until probably 3 or 4 weeks later when the follow-up rainfall came in early June that the Sakura was activated, but then or leaf, and only suppression was attained. And so we learned from that pairing Sakura with something like a trifluralin or a trilate was highly, highly valuable because products, particularly, say, both of those products, trifluralin and trilate, are quite volatile. They don't require moisture to be taken up into the plant. And so they were a great pairing, and not just only for the benefits of that wet, dry scenario, but I'm sure Mike will touch on herbicide resistance strategies and mix and matching different groups. We found that having a trifluralin or a trilate paired with a Sakura, and it would be the same again with something almost a lot of the other products too, which rely on moisture for uptake into the weeds, is pairing it with these trifluralin is definitely a way to go. And then I suppose the other option in these sorts of scenarios is getting that knockdown. And Mike touched on this also with his work, in that getting that knockdown is so much value. That small rainfall event comes through, the weeds come up, you take them out with the knockdown and you realize, oh, it's dry again. We can hold off until it rains with seeding. But one big lesson I pulled out of particularly the wild radish trial at the West Midlands site last year, in that we'd scouted the site out the November prior and it was rife with wild radish. There was thickets of it. And we thought, this is going to be an absolute ripper of a wild radish trial. And we ended up not seeding it. We probably seeded it 3 days too late because the rainfall event had gone through and it got a massive, massive, massive germination of weeds from it in mid-May, and we did a knockdown. And then not much radish came thereabouts thereafter because we'd taken it all out in the knockdown. Just showed how much we probably took out about 90% of the numbers in the knockdown, and it meant there was very little radish actually present in the site throughout the year. Whereas there was an adjacent site, I think I'm on yours, Nathan, was adjacent to that site, and you had sown that, I think it was about 5 days earlier than mine, and it hadn't got the knockdown benefit from that germination of weeds. The weeds had come up in the crop and it was filthy with weeds, but just showed the benefit of holding off a few days with seeding to get the benefit of the knockdown to really pull back that weed burden and take the pressure off the pre-emergent residual chemistry.
Yeah, and that's, I think that, Matt, that sort of comes to a wider point of actually understanding the seed bank that you've got in the field. So, as growers, you know that the site's got a high burden, it's got a low burden for ryegrass, and sort of that's going to correlate very, very heavily to the amount of weed seed that's actually in the soil. So, I always recommend in a drier situation, you start with your cleaner paddocks first, and then rotate your way back until you have to start seeding some of your dirtier paddocks, all right? But just give those dirtier paddocks the biggest chance to get a knockdown on them. And number two, if you've got a really, really dirty paddock, maybe we need to start rotating out of a cereal potentially into a canola or even into a pasture phase into one of those, because, when it comes to the weed control outputs here, the density of the weed seed bank is so important. And in the end of the day, that's really what we're after doing, is trying to regulate the size of that seed bank. I always tell growers that the weeds actually a symptom of a problem, and the greater problem is actually having a seed bank there, because that's where the weeds are going to come from. So, you know, basically managing where those weeds are, understanding how many are likely to hit your farming system when they come through is actually going to be really, really important there. So, you know, sow first your dirtier paddocks and then move towards your cleaner paddocks a little bit later. Change your order up.
Yep. And that weed seed bank, that final result, and I've come across this plenty of times before where I met up with a farmer in a paddock in mid-June and he wasn't happy with the level of weed control he'd gotten from his pre-emergent chemistry, and sort of sitting down and running through what had happened, like, if you've got really, really high numbers of weeds and you're getting upwards of 1,000 plants per square meter, if you're getting 90% control from an IBS product, which is quite good, that still leaves, in that scenario, 100 plants per square meter getting through. So if you're able to reduce that number that are in the crops from the season from, in a worst case scenario, 1,000 plants per square meter, even if you're pulling it back to a quarter of that by getting a really good knockdown in there, that really assists the pre-emergent chemistry in getting the job done. And yeah, I suppose that over-reliance on a single herbicide, a single application timing, is just put so much pressure on it. But if you can get that knockdown in there and have it alongside an IBS of residual chemistry, and then also having a non-herbicidal weed control in there as well, a multiple-prong attack is what can really drive those weed numbers down and ultimately the amount of weed seeds that are getting put back into the weed seed bank, which, as Mike's saying, is the ultimate problem trying to deal with here and reduce that number.
Yeah, and actually managing that weed seed bank to actually reduce it is the most important thing, but it's actually not as painful as growers think. Like, so we just finished a study where with Yassin Khalil where we actually did 2 years. We walked into a ryegrass site with over 7,000 ryegrass plants per square meter, absolutely feral, and it was multiple herbicide resistant. And 2 years of Ceradella with Trifluron up front and Paraquat spray topping, those ryegrass numbers were down to very, very, very low levels in that. So growers are able to sort of take a tiny break, get a paddock back in production, and the economics stack up. It's way better to do that and not have to fight this thing. You know, sometimes you just need to stop and recalibrate slightly and then go back in. You'll actually make more money.
And so we looked at the early break, then going, if we end up with a late break, how is that likely to impact on our strategies? You know, like in terms of will growers need to reassess, or I guess it'd be too late because if they start dry sowing.
Particularly with that later sowing timing, obviously it would have done a fair chunk of the program dry. And as Mike said, hopefully that was the lesser weedy paddocks, and then going with a later break, still got a few of those dirtier ones to get in. Yeah, I suppose I find that's been a really good opportunity at that later timing when the soil's in that, you get that late break, the soil gets wet up, is when you can use some of the higher risk products in terms of crop safety. And that's one thing we probably haven't touched on too much here. Yeah, it is some products you do need that separation between the herbicide and the crop seed and root system, because if not, then we're seeing biomass reductions, seedling mortality. We do need separation. The classic example over time has been something like a trifluralin. You do need that separation between the crop seed and the trifluralin. And a lot of some of these other newer products also have the same issue. Luximax was the classic from a couple of years ago, where people realized if they couldn't get that separation and follow what was on their herbicide label, they were seeing crop effect. And being able to get that separation is much more easily done in a wet conditions. You're able to control your seeding depth in a wet paddock. And that's really where I see a lot of the place for some of these higher risk products is seeding wet. We're able to control the depth, get that good separation between chemical and crop seed, as opposed to going in dry, where obviously you're up and down, get some shallow country, you can't get in there when it's bone dry. That's where we're seeing some crop effect. So, yeah, using those higher risk products like your Luximaxes a bit later on with a later break when it's wet, and lining up with what Mike was saying about the residual activity as well, where it's having a slightly shorter residual activity, that's going to be less punishing if you are applying it first week of June than it is if you're applying it at Anzac Day. That sort of 5-6 weeks, makes a bit of a difference.
Yeah, so my comment would be to sort of obviously rotate your chemistry throughout the season. So, if you're going in dry, you're obviously going to need to go in with a strategy of including some of these more residual products. So ensuring that you've got a really robust rate there to provide that longevity when it starts to get wet. So, that's a scenario when it's going dry. But then when it's wet, we actually found, and you get a good knockdown, your trifluralins and your luxamaxes start to come into the picture. They start to give really particularly good control. You know, people forget that one of the most dangerous times for crop safety is around emergence. That's when basically the seed is imbibing water. And if it imbibes any water with a herbicide in it, it's at its absolute most dangerous, it's most effective. So, you know, ensuring that a product, especially when you're going in dry, that the product is quite safe for that wheat is going to be very important. And I concur with Matt that, you know, if you're, the soil is wet, you've got good furrow stability there, you've got a good amount of soil moisture to buffer that herbicide there, and also that the seed is able to be sown relatively shallowly, get out of the ground and get moving quickly, it's a lot safer situation. So you can tend to be a little bit more dangerous. The other thing is just, you know, I'd always say to everybody, whether it's, especially if you're going dry, ramp up your seeding rate. I know that it's counterintuitive that you're thinking you're going to have a bad season, but you are not getting the value of a knockdown there. You're putting so much pressure on these pre-emergent herbicides that you really need to think about adding more redundancy into that farming system. So, you know, if I think about that, I think, you know, we need to ramp up the competition if we can, you know, and you can do that in multiple ways by changing your variety potentially to a more higher biomass variety, reduce your row spacing or upping your seeding rate. But then also think about how much more redundancy we can add in. If something does survive, can we actually do at the end of the season? Can we spray top? How can we use more harvest weed seed control, for instance, to stop anything going back into the soil? That's really, really vital when it comes to dry seeding. When it comes to delayed seeding, your knockdown is really helping you a lot there. But you still need to make sure that anything that survives, yeah, there's a good potential. Anything that does survive has got a resistance capacity to it. So we need to stop any of that seed going back into that soil seed bank there. So, you know, harvest weed seed control is really, really important there. Knowing that, you know, one thing we know about ryegrass is that, you know, ryegrass is becoming a little bit more dormant. We need probably 3 solid years. If we can get 3 years of zero weed seed set or zero weed seed going back into the soil, we're going to obliterate a seed bank there and we can bring paddocks right back into production. So, you know, I've worked with growers that have very, very clean paddocks. For instance, I remember trying to sample a site where it took me 45 minutes to find one ryegrass plant in a wheat field. Okay. Now, this farmer had the exact same tools as every other grower. The only difference between this grower and a lot of other growers is he had a standard that said, I'm not going to allow anything to set seed. And he, you know, basically he was charging. He was getting massive yields because he could farm just to maximise yield, not to fight the ryegrass, for instance. So, you know, all I can say to everybody is just look at your farming system, look at how much pressure you're putting up front. And if you're putting a lot of pressure up front, then look at how much additional redundancy I can add into this farming system. Because weed control is a system. It's certainly not a product. It's certainly not, you can't get weed control out of a can. It's all about how you apply a wide, broad range of systems there.
Mm. And I think it's really important to be persistent and not let there be, I suppose the one thing you need to avoid during that period of driving down weed numbers is having that one blowout. 1 year of having a blowout can offset that hard work from 2 or 3 years of driving weed numbers down. So it's a matter of being persistent, being disciplined every year to make sure that, yeah, that these weed seeds aren't getting back into the seed bank and building numbers up again.
And we had that last year where especially lupin crops, I don't know if you saw a lot of those, actually got, they physically died, didn't they? Mm. Because of the amount of water that was around. There's some huge ryegrass seed banks out there, you know, on the back of 2021. So the question is, what do we do with those? Do we actually go out of crop or do we put a lot of pressure on these pre-emergents? I'm not quite sure what I'd tell a grower to do. However, you know, if you're going to put a lot of pressure on these herbicides, you need to factor in a truckload of redundancy in there because you can't let anything set seed, because you've got to remember that anything that survived 2021, it probably had quite a few potential, you know, if it was in a lupin, for instance, it probably had a truckload of select put across it. So there's, you know, probably selected for a lot of resistance there. We need to make sure that none of this stuff sets seed. We need to get those seed banks down really, really low. And if I can sort of, you know, as a real final message from me, is just really get growers to focus on the seed bank, not necessarily the number of weeds they're getting, okay? If they're getting a lot of weeds, they're coming up throughout the season, but they're not letting, but none of those weeds are setting any seed, viable seed to go back into the soil, that is a big win, okay? So just, you know, don't, you know, just look at the amount of seed going back into the soil. That's where you're going to win the battle.
Mm. And tooting my own horn again with Martino, just showing that being able to go with that EP application means you are getting those two cracks at the ryegrass. You still have your IBS component with a trifluralin or a trilat or a sulfocarb up front, then coming back with a second application with a pyroxysulfone, a clonopin, two active ingredients which are working very well on the ryegrass. It's giving two cracks across the whole soil surface in furrow, furrow wall, and inter row. Having that higher level of control is pulling back the weed numbers and the amount of seed being set. And once again, by having that pyroxysulfone in there, moving that tail end of the residual to the back end of the season, that means that any later cohorts that do get through or any weeds that do get through the initial application will be suppressed. They'll have their roots pruned. You'll notice that you pull the weeds up in September and compare it to something that's had a trifluralin or even a nothing at all. And you'll see the root systems, even though the weeds are there and they've gotten through, have been compromised and will set very little in the way of seeds because, you know, they've got no root systems. It dries out throughout September. They aren't able to access the moisture and then they don't set seeds. So that strength of having that higher level of weed control, then in combination with your non-herbicidal strategies, is your ultimate goal in terms of reducing weed seed numbers.
Yep. So, yeah, sort of trying to very much, you know, mix the pre-emergent herbicide with a very competitive crop is going to do you a lot of benefit there. So you need to put these herbicides in that right context. For instance, we actually had another trial sitting right next to the pre-emergent trial at West Midlands there last year looking at canola. And it was really quite surprising where we found that when we increased canola seeding rate, if we got an establishment rate around 35 plants per square metre, we basically had no ryegrass or wild radish in it. It was a fantastic result. You can't underestimate the value of crop competition. Yet, you know, we got to look at those one percenters of controlling the little rabbit runs, making sure there's no holes, you know, getting your root disease under control. Grow a big crop equals less weeds, to be brutally honest. We see that all the time.
Yeah. And we've actually looking at a trial this year for the West Midlands Spring Field Day site that's, again, looking at the impact of seed density and impact on weeds. Mm. So I think I'm wary of time that Matt's got a trundle on, and we have pretty much covered everything. I've kind of progressed into everything that I wanted to cover. Where can listeners go for more information? As I've mentioned, we've got articles in our West Midlands Quarterly. Comes out, next one will be due out in April. Mike, where's the best place to go from your perspective to get more information on weed management strategies?
Yeah. So there's a lot of places you can go. Obviously, you know, have a look at the ARI website. There's a lot of information there. I always recommend growers to download the RIM program and have a play. Okay. You can actually plug the parameters of your own farming system in there. You know, at being a desktop farmer, you can plug in all the different weed control parameters and you can see the amount of ryegrass that's being produced. This stuff's been done over 30 years. It's been modeled. And, you know, if you're thinking about the value of a technology, play with it on there first and you'll get a good idea. The other thing is that GRDC actually have an excellent integrated weed management portal there where you can have a look at. And a lot of information from us, South Australia, Gurjeet Gill, and even Victoria, it all gets pulled in there. And so there's a lot of trials and a lot of research to have a look at there. So have a look. There's a lot of information out there if you want to look into this.
Cool. And Matt, from your perspective, where do you go for information? And more importantly, where can listeners go for more information on Martino Complete?
Well, Bayer, we accumulate a lot of data, a lot of technical information, a lot of resources for people to access. The best way to get hold of it is our website. So just type in Bayer, Martino Complete or Sakura or Velocity, any of our products, and you better go to our website where all the resources, tech guides, information sheets, FAQs are all there. The label, crop label and SDS, they're all there for you to access to have a look through. If you want to speak to myself directly, you can get my details through the West Midlands Group, and I'm happy to have a chat on the phone at any moment as well. To run through any questions you've got about it, any information you need about Bayer products, we've got the resources there for you.
And finally, last question that we ask most people is, what keeps you interested in agriculture?
For me, I've always been, I like bringing solutions. All the way my time, been an agronomist, a researcher, and now with Bayer, I just love seeing a problem and be able to provide a solution to a grower to solve that problem. And so my current role, it is quite rewarding. If we do bring something to market which does plug a gap or does fix an issue, resistance, all these things which are coming through, being able to bring something which solves that problem, it's very rewarding for me. So, yeah, that's my big thing I love to do.
Yeah, for me, I've been really lucky in my journey within agriculture. My first job, I was actually an agricultural engineer before this, you know, spending time with Wonfa working on seeding systems. It was great fun. And then coming to ARI, we're working on probably, one of the biggest threats to ag, which is herbicide-resistant weeds. So talking to growers that are really interested, trying to find solutions that are out of the box, and we're also trying to sort of dance between theoretical and practical. It's good fun. Plus, just being able to hang around this cool state, it's a big state. You can enjoy it. You know, we're lucky in that regard.
That's it. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you for your time today. And, yeah, we look forward to working with both of you into the future.
Thanks for having us, Nathan. And good to chat with you and you too, Mike. It was good fun.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Nathan.
That brings us to the end of this Paddock Chat episode. We hope you've enjoyed the conversation and have picked up some beneficial tips, useful information, and timely advice from our special guests. We would like to extend our thanks and appreciation to Mike and Matt for being so generous with both their time and knowledge. The best way to receive our updates and stay in the loop with the latest in local research and results is by becoming a West Midlands Group member. Our members are an essential part of why we do what we do at WMG, and we pride ourselves on ensuring they receive relevant, timely, and innovative information wherever they are and whatever they're doing. Becoming a WMG member ensures you'll save hours of your valuable time with easy access to the most relevant and up-to-date information you really need whenever you need it. A membership gets you early access to our workshops, free or discounted entry for up to 3 farm business members to our major events, and exclusive access to our member-only publications like our monthly e-newsletters and quarterly technical publication. For more info, visit our website where you can sign up anytime. I'd like to thank our sponsors and members, without whom this would not be possible. See you next time for more Paddock Chat. Local knowledge from a paddock near you.